Good morning. Are Hawaii taxpayers not getting truthful financial information about our state's real debt? Sheila Weinberg says so. We'll talk with the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting about the State Data Lab report out today. And with primaries in several Northeast states, news analyst Neil Conan will no doubt have something to say about that and other events later in the hour. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. There's no telling how far you can go with the right attitude and the right coach. That's one of the lessons of author Julie Checkaway's three-year swim club, The Untold Story of Maui's Sugar Ditch Kids. And Seabury Hall dance director David Ward sets out to create a new tradition with the Common Ground Dance Festival.
That's the conversation for Tuesday, April 28th. I'm sorry, April 26th. Stay here for the conversation coming up after the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
I just learned a new term this morning, sinkhole state.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that one in just a minute. But you know that Hawaii and Alaska are often viewed as having a whole lot in common. You know, they're far from the mainland, and now, as you just alluded to, they're also far from each other financially. A report out today shows Alaska with a $52,000 surplus for each of its taxpayers, while Hawaii taxpayers shoulder a burden of $28,000. That's one of the comparisons drawn from the State Data Lab, a project of the Chicago-based Truth in Accounting. Its founder and CEO is CPA Sheila Weinberg, and when we talked early today, I asked why they call Hawaii a sinkhole state.
Because it is actually sinking in debt. It has a lot more bills than it does have assets to pay them. So we calculate that, you know, the bills are $19 billion, but it only has about $6 billion to pay it. So we're about $12 to $13 billion in the hole.
When you do these calculations, I know you're using a proprietary method, but how could you describe that method that might give people confidence that these numbers are in fact correct? Because we know that numbers can be, you know, moved around a lot.
Yeah, what we do is we take the state's audited financial report, and unfortunately those reports do not report all of their pension liability and all of their retiree health care liability. So we go to the actuary reports that the state issues to get those, and we add those off-balance sheet pension and retiree health care liabilities to come up with the true bills.
Don't we, though, now have to report the unfunded liabilities so that people can see them?
Fortunately, yes, you're correct. This year, the state did have to report its pension liability, but it's not until another couple years that it has to report the $9.1 billion of retiree health care liabilities that you guys have. And then we also did find that even though the state is required to report their pension liability, they're using, for some reason, they're using 2014 numbers instead of 2015 numbers. So the numbers are understated by $1.2 billion.
As you look at Hawaii in the context of other states, obviously Hawaii is a much smaller state. You're using the actual numbers that you've been able to draw from various state reports. But in Hawaii's case, is there anything special that you looked at that might be different than in other states?
Well, number one, it's one of our, last year it was in 2014, it was one of our worst states. And then number two, it's very unusual that you guys have a lot more retiree health care benefits than you do pension benefits. You have a large amount of pension benefits at $6.9 billion, but then you even have more retiree health care benefits that you've promised of $9.1 billion.
And that's been an issue as we've been having conversation about how the state moves forward. As you look at Hawaii through the lens of transparency to the public, which is pretty much the lens that you're looking at all the states, how would you advise people to be perhaps a little bit more circumspect when they hear numbers that come out of the state? Because clearly that seems to be the intent of the report.
Yeah, you know, that's our whole point is, you know, the governments have not been forthright in coming up with their numbers. So I would be, one thing I would be cautious about is the state declaring a, quote, surplus. To you and me, that means, whoa, they must have extra cash sitting around to spend. But all it means is that your checkbook balance at the end of the year is higher. And, you know, they can say that they're running a surplus or balance the budget. But, again, you know, they have these huge unfunded pension and retiree health care debt. So, you know, I really wouldn't call that a surplus or balancing your budget.
And is that why those, you know, hidden costs, as they were, show up perhaps in the following year where we find out that we, in fact, don't have a surplus, but, in fact, we have a deficit?
Yes, and that's part of it. I call the budget numbers in a budget document pretty much just a political document. It really based upon their version of math. And the real, quote, truer numbers come out when the state issues its audited financial statement, which is what we use to produce our numbers.
That leaves a lot of people feeling very much in the dark, perhaps, because, as you mentioned, you can fool around with numbers and you can use whatever math you like to be able to hide something external to a budget or to be able to include it depending upon what law requires. In the case of Hawaii, where we're a sinkhole state in your mind, but maybe progressing a little bit better, looking at the chart over the last 6 years, it's gotten a tiny bit better. And I know that's why you looked at us a little differently perhaps this year, but what would you suggest for Hawaii so that we somehow are able to dig ourselves out of the sinkhole?
Well, what I would have them do, you know, what we call fact-based budgeting, and in that you include all of your costs, all of your compensation costs, that would require you to, you know, fund your pensions properly and also to fund your retiree health care benefit properly. So get all the costs included in the budget, and that's a good step forward.
Would that even be possible, given the fact that we have so much in the hole already?
Well, again, they have a plan to pay it off slowly. The pensions are doing a better job at funding the retiree health care benefits. They're also doing a better job at funding, but they're still not funding enough. So fund more. If you can't fund it properly, include all the costs in your budget, then, you know, when they issue the budget, okay, you guys can use whatever, what I call political math to pretend you balance the budget. But before you pass the budget, let the citizens know what the real numbers are. How much more unfunded retirement debt are we accruing, even though you guys are saying that we balance the budget? So at least, you know, the numbers are out there when they pass that, quote, balanced budget.
Your bottom line seems to be that although we have a mandate to have a balanced budget, that in the minds of average citizens, that needs to be tempered by the idea that we have all these other things that are external to the budget that necessarily haven't been figured in. Is that what you really want to have people walk away understanding, is that these numbers are really not good numbers, period?
Yeah, and also that they are making decisions on, you know, their policy and who they elect for based upon these bad numbers. So they really need to look at, you know, better numbers. We provide them at our statedatalab.org website, which can give you the more accurate numbers for Hawaii. So when you vote and when you hear about budget numbers, you know, keep in mind the budget, you know, you can balance your, you know, that then you and I can balance our budget by just putting all our costs on our credit cards. And that's what they've been doing, that, hey, we balanced our budget, but we've put a lot of compensation costs on our pension and our retiree health care benefit credit cards.
Or as a lot of people like to say in this state, they're kicking the can down the road.
Yes, I would call them. And, you know, I would have, you know, if your listeners talk to a legislator, you know, I really don't quite understand how you've been balancing your budget, or you say we have a balanced budget now, but we need $13.6 billion to cover all the bills that we've accrued so far.
Sheila Weinberg, I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you for having me on and covering this most important topic.
Sheila Weinberg is the founder and CEO of Truth in Accounting. Since 2002, she's led the group's research initiatives, including the annual Financial State of the States report and the Financial State of the Union. The link to the State Data Lab is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's now 8:15. Coming up, the all-but-forgotten story of Maui's sugar ditch kids. But first, here's your backyard quiz.
In just a minute, we'll hear about a group of plantation-era kids from Maui who took the swimming world by storm and set their sights on the Olympics. While the early part of the 20th century was the heyday of local swimming achievement, Hawaii has been producing and attracting world-class competitive swimmers for decades. Your mind may jump to the Kona-based Ironman Triathlon series, but there's another globe-spanning swim series that also prominently features Hawaii. This one is not a large annual race, but rather a multi-leg individual endurance challenge. It features 7 long-distance open-water swims in locations all over the planet, and one of those is here in Hawaii. If you can tell us the name of this swim series and which Hawaii body of water it incorporates, you'll have a shot at an HPR t-shirt. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right will get a t-shirt.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Book and Music Festival. David Davis discusses Waterman, his biography of Duke Kahanamoku, this Sunday at noon on the grounds of Honolulu Hale. HawaiiBookAndMusicFestival.com.
American history is filled with stories of people who overcame limitations, refusing to stay within assigned boundaries. For young Japanese Americans in Hawaii in the 30s and 40s, there are more than enough of those, but there's not much that real determination can't overcome. It took an inspired and unconventional coach to take a group of young swimmers on Maui all the way to the Olympics, and author Julie Checkaway, author of the 3-Year Swim Club, The Untold Story of Maui's Sugar Ditch Kids and Their Quest for Olympic Glory, is on the line. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Chris. Glad to be here.
You must have really felt that you'd gotten on to something when you found out about this story, yeah?
I really did. It was 2008, and I was working as a reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune when someone called me just off the cuff and told me the basic outline of this story. And she said, "Do you think it's possibly true?" And I thought, my goodness, if it's true, it's one of the greatest untold stories in American history.
Yeah, like, I hope it's true, right?
Yeah. And what was remarkable was that as I began to dig as much as I could in the beginning, I found that everything checked out. And more than that, it was not only a fantastic story, it was a really important story, not only for Maui, Hawaii, but for the United States. And also, it covered all sorts of aspects of world history in the first half of the 20th century.
Sure. And you know, the story that everyone is familiar with in Hawaii is the story of the 442nd and the 100th Battalion.
Absolutely.
And it's a similar arc in the sense of Japanese Americans proving themselves, overcoming limitations, yeah?
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet, what's interesting is, I think on the mainland, you have a familiarity with that story of the 442nd, and then you also, which is a story of victorious and brave people, and then you also have the story of internment, which is a story of courageous and suffering and brave people.
Yeah.
But in between that story is this 3-year swim club story, which has gotten elided in some way by history, by those two stories, but also by the climate of racial prejudice at that time. and also by collective memory. History favors winners, and unless you look at this story carefully, it might seem that the three-year swim club, because they were kept from the 1940 Olympics and the 44 Olympics, were not the winners of this story, the heroes. Rather, though, they really are, and the book tells the story of their triumph going into the 1940s and 1948, when one of the members of the three-year swim club was a member of the American Olympic swim team in London in 1948.
Well, it asks you to redefine winner, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. The book really is about that very thing. It's such a good comment that you made, because while not all of the swimmers made it to the Olympics, most of the swimmers qualified for the Olympics. They were national champs. In their first year, they beat out Olympians in the pool. They beat out collegiate swimmers. They went on in their second year to be not only national champs individually, but to go on and become national champs as a team in the AAUs. Third year, same thing. Fourth year, the same thing. And they were known as the best swimmers in the entire world. They were declared by Arthur Daly of the New York Times as the greatest swimmers in the world.
At the same time, these are kids who didn't even have a pool and whose coach could barely swim, right?
That's correct. Suichi Sakamoto was a sixth-grade science teacher in Punane, Maui. He was himself a middle-class guy, was not born on a plantation. The kids grew up in the segregated camps there, and they did not have access to a swimming pool until 1936. Suichi Sakamoto coached them in the ditches, the irrigation ditches, and he made up interval training. He taught himself and made up swimming. He had no idea really how to swim, could do some survival swimming. It wasn't until 36 that the Baldwin family built on the plantation a very beautiful pool in which the kids could practice. And in 37, that's when Suichi Sakamoto saw the great progress in swimmers like Hala Hirose, in Kiyo Nakama, Jose Balmores, Fujiko Katsutani, all names that swimmers know well. And he said, we're going to go to the Olympics in 3 years. Let's form the three-year swim club, 1937. In 40, we're going to Tokyo, and we're going to represent the United States of America.
You know, in a way, Julie, the whole Coach Sakamoto's thing is sort of a tribute to what would now be called out-of-the-box thinking, right? Because he wasn't a swimming coach. His methods were entirely unconventional and and really went against the way swimming was coached at the time, and yet it produced almost immediate results, right?
Absolutely. Sakamoto went against, he didn't know he was going against everything that was believed about athletics or about swimming. It was believed generally in the collegiate world, in the AAU, and in Olympic swimming, that swimmers should not exert themselves very much. And so, you know, the joke I make is that most collegiate swimmers at Harvard or Yale would do a quick lap in the pool and then have a vigorous rub down and a fine cigar.
There you go.
What Sakamoto did was look to the fields around him and also to the mill, the sugar mill, and he saw the intensity with which the children's parents worked. And he used that as a model for what they should do in the pool to achieve their goals. He also met with tremendous, tremendous opposition from the powers on the island who felt he was burning the kids out.
Which is a whole, I mean, it really revolutionized the approach, not just to that sport, but to the way a lot of sports are trained now. But, you know, the whole thing of, like, of not overtiring when you're training is absurd. That's been thrown out the window, yeah?
Absolutely. Sakamoto just believed he only had 3 years to do it, and so he had no choice but to work the kids hard.
Yeah.
But he also saw that model of the children's parents in the field. And he pushed them so hard that his style and his method of coaching has become a model today for how people coach in a variety of sports. He invented, as I said, interval training, assisted sprint training, dry land training, weight training, and he did this all with materials that he found scavenged basically on the plantation grounds.
Well, Julie, it's the kind of story that, you know, if you can't draw lessons from it, you're really not paying attention. And it's a terrific story. Thanks so much for talking with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Julie Checkaway is the author of The 3-Year Swim Club, The Untold Story of Maui's Sugar Ditch Kids and Their Quest for Olympic Glory. She'll be speaking at the 2016 Hawaii Book and Music Festival Sunday, May 1st. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, a locally owned company serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Pennsylvania's confusing delegate free-for-all.
They could actually not only negate their own vote, but actually cost their candidate support.
The GOP race to 1237 collides with a primary where delegates are unbound and most voters have no idea of the rules. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, following The Conversation.
The station's spring drive successfully completed earlier this month, and we welcome new members and say thanks to our current members and to these community partners, Booz Allen Hamilton, Hawaii Literacy, and Napoleons. Mahalo to all of you for your support during Challenge 2016. Hawaii's need for teachers is real, but the viral stories of teaching in paradise are nothing but clickbait. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has the story in today's Reality Check. Oh boy, this one got under my skin, gotta tell you. I mean, amazing the nonsense that is out there that just seems to prove that, yes, indeed, there's a sucker born every minute.
Right, and kudos to Jessica Terrell and Eric Pape, who wrote this story up on our website today. So let me give you the background. Back in April, the Associated Press ran a story about how Hawaii was seeking to hire 1,600 teachers. Now, that's nothing new. We've had a teacher shortage for two decades. The DOE has long advertised, including on the mainland. But this story was picked up and essentially twisted to have the headline say this: Hawaii will pay you $50,000 a year to work in paradise. Oh, and it was picked up by all sorts of publications, including legitimate ones like Travel and Leisure, Women's Day. I don't know if I would include the New York Post, but they picked it up as well. And what happened is the Department of Education has just been flooded with really frivolous inquiries. 600 just last week, 8,300 total, and they're online. You can actually go on the website. We've actually pulled a couple of the applications and looked at them, and they're unfortunately hilarious. People without very good grammar or skills, typos, people applying to be teachers of all things. It's really quite an embarrassment.
An embarrassment and a whole lot for the DOE to have to slog through and deal with as they're looking for legitimate teachers.
It really is, and there's a lot of misinformation. For example, some have reported that there's a wave of retirement here among our teachers. That is not the case at all. It's just one of many factors. There's no particular spike. There is a high turnover rate for our teachers, particularly in rural areas, but that doesn't mean you can come out here for a couple of years, teach, and then go back to your home in the mainland. In fact, it's very difficult to work in rural areas. We've reported on how demoralizing it can be. It is not an extended working vacation, as some people are painting it out to be. And finally, the starting pay for a teacher in the DOE is actually $34,000. Yes, you can get up to 50, 54,000 or so. But even then, as we know here in Hawaii, that doesn't go very far because of our high cost of living.
So I've got to ask you, is there anything that's coming out to be able to combat this aside from some of what you've put out there through Civil Beat?
Well, it's interesting. The Hawaii State Teachers Association called the other day. They wanted to post a pod squad that we had done on this exact topic to try and get out the information, if you will, to clear up the disinformation that's out there. This story is already getting a lot of attention, and we worked with the DOE to make sure that we had the correct information on what's going on. So maybe we can counter it, but as you know, the way the internet works, once something goes viral, it is very, very hard to dial it back, to reel it in and ground things in reality, because sensationalism is much more interesting.
And people want to believe what they want to believe anyway.
Yeah, they do. And back to square one, we still have a serious shortage of teachers. Hopefully there will be some applicants that will come out of this. But as I said, so many of them are ridiculous. One of the things the DOE is worried is, gee, they hope they don't miss actually a good applicant who's applying because of this flood of frivolous inquiries.
Right, and how much they're going to have to wade through. Thanks, Chad.
Thanks, Bethann.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us daily with a reality check.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
It's now 8:30. I'm Chris Vandercook, and you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can reach us in a variety of ways through our talkback line, 808-792-8217. On Facebook, we're Hawaii Conversation. On Twitter, we're HI Conversation, our BKOZHPR. If you like email, that's talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, finding common ground in dance styles from around the world after this news from the Deutsche Welle.
And in the U.S., presidential frontrunners are looking to land knockouts in the Northeast today. There's a growing alliance between Australia and Japan that suffered a serious blow, and the meaning of Deflategate. Yes, that's one of the stories on the mind of news analyst Neil Conan this week. He joins us, as he does most Tuesdays, from his Macnut farm on the Big Island. Seriously, Neil, Deflategate?
Hang on, you'll see.
Okay, all right. Let's start with the conventional stuff. Let's look at politics. Last week, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump posted victories in New York. Both are expected to do well again in the 5 northeastern states today. At long last, could this be the decisive day for both of them?
No, but for different reasons. The Democratic presidential race has actually been over for a while now. You could say Nevada or Florida and Ohio, but after New York, Secretary Clinton is certainly out of reach. Now, Senator Sanders' campaign has continued and will continue. It's fueled by enthusiasm and by money. All of those individual contributions allowed his campaign to outspend Clinton's by about 2-1 in New York, but all those ads and the big rallies and the fervent idealism added up to a 16-point loss. He's going to lose more ground today, and the only tactical question that remains is about how he decides to handle the transition eventually to concession and endorsement.
Which is not going to be easy, but you said tactical question. Is there a strategic question still out there for Senator Sanders?
Oh, yes, I think there is. And it involves what he always called his political revolution and what has to be crushing disappointment. He and his supporters came to believe this would happen in 2016, but the contest for the future of the progressive movement is not this year, but 4 years from now. Everybody's noticed that further down the ballot you go, the thinner the Democrats look. And I'm focusing on state legislatures here. Every 10 years, state legislatures redraw congressional district lines. So after a Republican wave election in 2010, we got a situation where the Democrats easily win more votes in congressional elections, but Republicans have a lock on the House of Representatives itself.
This is from gerrymandering?
Well, gerrymandering is what you call it when the other party does it. But yes, both parties draw those congressional lines for maximum partisan advantage. Look at Ohio is a good example on the Republican side. Maryland is a good one for the Democrats. But 2020, that's a presidential election year when more Democrats will turn out to vote. And if Bernie Sanders can motivate his supporters to organize now to win state assembly and state senate seats 4 years from now, that could change the political map for a decade at least.
Okay, but even if that happens, won't they just gerrymander for Democrats?
Well, they could. But there are models in Arizona and California of different, I'm not going to say nonpartisan actually, but less partisan ways to redraw the lines or change the process to make congressional races more competitive, make Congress more responsive. So there are real possibilities out there if the Sanders campaign can be the start of the hard work of actual politics and not just, you know, sort of a romantic failure.
Okay, all right. I'm going to leave that for a second, get back to today. And the other party, can Donald Trump land a knockout blow today?
Not today. He will likely go five for five today and pick up something like 100 pledged delegates. The knockout will come next week. Indiana is winner take all. Trump is leading there in the polls, but it will be the last stand of the Stop Trump movement. And if John Kasich and Ted Cruz can actually work together and swing that race to Cruz, they have a shot to hold Mr. Trump below the threshold for a first ballot nomination.
That seems to be a big if. I mean, right now that Kasich-Cruz alliance looks a little shaky.
Yes, and it's probably at least a month too late. If Trump wins Indiana, he becomes the presumptive nominee. California, New Jersey should put him over the top pretty easily.
And how about Republicans accepting him as a standard bearer? I mean, are they going to really rally around?
Some will, with varying degrees of enthusiasm. But a substantial fraction has already rejected Trump, either because they don't think he's a proper conservative, and by their lights he is not, but more because of the catalog of really hateful things he said about, you know, Mexicans and Muslims and women. They simply can't stand him.
He did give a rather restrained victory speech in New York last week, though, and then we heard that he would show his presidential demeanor from here on out. So how might that sync with his big speech on foreign policy tomorrow?
I don't think he can help himself when he gets in front of a crowd. You know, he'll probably read from a script in that foreign policy speech, and there might even be policies there. Who knows? But when he gets in front of a crowd at a rally, I think he reveals a part of his character that feeds on emotion. And he knows, as he said, every time the energy seems to, you know, flag a little bit, all he has to do is promise to, you know, build that wall. Nobody is ever going to forget what he's said so far and what he's promised to do. And I don't think he's going to be able to sustain what would, you know, be a veneer of respectability.
Okay, all right. We're going to move on to international news for a second. Now, today you reported in the Pacific News Minute about Australia's decision to award a huge submarine contract to France. And everybody thought that deal was going to go to Japan. What happened?
The Australians say this is just about technical issues. The French submarine is a superior product, they say. The French promised to build all of them in Australia. Jobs are a big part of it, and, you know, Australia has elections coming up. But there are big league politics here. The Australians may have burned a very important bridge with Japan.
So how much did Japan actually have invested in this deal?
Oh, quite a bit. Prime Minister Abe changed a fundamental interpretation of Japan's pacifist post-war constitution to allow the export of weapons. I mean, he did this expressly for the Australians. It was a very big deal. It cost him political capital. But more broadly, this deal was supposed to be the cement of a wider coalition between Australia, Japan, and the United States. Now that's up in the air. We're going to have to see how badly the Japanese respond to this. But, you know, it's not just a disappointment. You know, the Germans made a bid for the submarine contract, too. You know, you win some, you lose some from the Germans' point of view. For Japan, this is likely to be taken as an insult.
How big of an insult?
That's going to be determined. I'm not sure how they're going to react. It's particularly that they, you know, from their point of view, Prime Minister Abe went out on a limb for Australia in terms of, you know, changing the Constitution, the interpretation of the Constitution. It's something he wanted to do anyway. Maybe Australia can do something else, but right now almost all of the other major weapons contracts they have coming up are, you know, American weapon systems. And frankly, if the United States built a diesel electric submarine, it only builds nukes, the Australians would have bought that.
All right, we got to leave the serious stuff for a second. And I got to ask you about this because you promised Deflategate. You know, for those who forgot, this was the long, long saga of what happened to the footballs at the Patriots-Colts playoff game two seasons ago. So did celebrated quarterback Tom Brady of the Patriots actually instruct team employees to deflate the footballs to give them an advantage?
A league investigation found that he probably did. Other investigations poured some questions on it. But in any case, the NFL punished the Patriots. They don't have a first-round or a fourth-round pick in this week's upcoming draft. They were also fined $1 million. And then the league suspended Brady for four games. He took that to federal court and won. Yesterday, a federal appeals court overturned that ruling. Now Brady and the Players Union have to decide whether they're going to take their case to the Supreme Court.
Wait. The Supreme Court? Are you kidding me? I mean, the violation here, if there indeed were one, has been compared to a speeding ticket. Doesn't the Supreme Court have better things to do?
Well, let's hope so. But, you know, there's a larger issue here. Football is simultaneously the most popular sport in the country, far and away, and it's also a deeply troubled institution. All the ongoing revelations about concussions and the way that, you know, day-to-day contact damages the brain puts us at a crossroad. We now know that playing this game in high school, in college, certainly in the pros, just playing the game is all too likely to lead to brain damage and, in too many cases, to early death. The larger implication of Deflategate is that the future of the game is likely going to be decided in the courts. There's, you know, going to be no way to escape our knowledge that schools and athletic conferences and professional leagues knowingly promote participation in a game they know to be dangerous. That's a liability nightmare, and it should be. If we can't resolve Deflategate outside of the courtroom, we're not going to be able to, you know, come to some agreement on how to reduce the violence in the game to make it safe or even safer without the courts winding up as the final arbiters.
You make a good argument. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks very much, Beth Ann. Talk to you next week.
You bet. We'll talk to you then. News analyst Neil Conan joins us on most Tuesdays from the farm. You can also hear his Pacific News Minutes right here on Hawaii Public Radio. And now we're going to get to our backyard quiz answer that deals with another sport. Today, we asked you about a long-distance swim series that incorporates a leg here in Hawaii. The series in question is the crown jewel of open water swimming accomplishments and is considered the swimming equivalent to Mountaineering's Seven Summits Challenge. The series in question incorporates seven separate events across the globe. Only six people have completed all seven swims, making them one of the most elite groups of athletes on Earth. In order to gain entrance to this rarefied club, a swimmer must complete and document unassisted crossings of the English Channel, the Catalina Channel, New Zealand's Cook Channel, and the Strait of Gibraltar, plus the North Channel between Scotland and Ireland, Japan's Tsugaru Strait, and the Ka'iwi Channel here in Hawaii, also known as the Molokai Channel. Those seven crossings make up the long-distance swimming challenge known as the Ocean's Seven. That was today's answer. Nobody got it, so we'll just keep our T-shirt until tomorrow. And now at 8:47, if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
If there's anything resembling a universal language in this crazy world, it's the language of dance. And we're at a moment in history when dance styles are being merged as never before. In his capacity as director of dance at Seabury Hall on Maui, David Ward is putting together a dance program that brings together jazz, modern, ballet, hip-hop, musical, and contemporary styles to music that ranges from the Brandenburg Concerto to Girls Just Want to Have Fun. He's on the line from his studio. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Chris.
the borders are really have kind of disappeared, haven't they?
Well, in many ways, yes, because, you know, even on the professional level, companies that want to thrive have to find a way to incorporate all these genres that will bring, really the youth out to support and be energized by new forms of dance.
Sure. Well, it used to be, you know, that if you were studying ballet, your instructors didn't want you to do tap or you know, because it would kind of dilute your technique. Yeah, isn't that accurate?
Well, I think in some ways, you know, if someone's a purist, that you're still going to have that. I mean, if someone's going to train in classical ballet, they need to be pretty serious.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that we can't come together as communities, like in this festival format, where, you know, you're bringing a variety of people together that are really expert in their areas and sharing it all together in one stage and one format. Kind of a celebration of what dance can be, what the possibilities are.
Sure. And in a way, that's a response to an audience that has kind of opened its mind to all these different styles.
Well, and if their minds are not open, they soon will be.
That's a good way to approach it, David. Yeah.
Well, because, you know, for me, this is like, really, this has been a dream of mine. You know, I come from a modern dance background as a professional dancer, but I have always loved musical theater and jazz and of course, classical ballet. But I also have a deep love for cultural dance. And, of course, in Hawaii, what better place is there? So, you know, all those dance forms that you had mentioned, but we also have a halaus that are going to be there. We have a taiko group that's going to be performing. So I'm really trying to bring together, you know, a cross-cultural group of dance and movement arts that celebrates the richness that we have here in Hawaii as arts education, you know, flourishes in movement arts.
Well, you know, and yet there's so many, just within those styles that you described, there's so many different approaches. I mean, I think in terms of, you know, hula, in a sense, is very grounded, sort of close to the earth dance, as opposed to ballet, is a gravity-defying approach, right?
So, absolutely.
So the whole, that arc from one extreme to another, that's a pretty huge difference right there.
Well, and it is. And so you're going to have people that are going to come to this festival that are specifically say, I heard this so-and-so, you know, is going to be there, or this halau is going to be there, or this taiko group. And maybe they're not someone who would normally go see a classical ballet or would go see a jazz piece or a jazz concert.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it may open their eyes and their hearts to the possibilities that are out there. And when you see the infectious energy of these young people that are so inspired and so passionate about what they're doing, you know, you can't help but get, you know, just feel overjoyed by the experience, right? So our hope is just to open new doors, open, you know, create new opportunities and bring new people into the fold of what's out there.
Because I would think just for you as an instructor, David, that there are all these styles of dance that have come along since you had your training, right?
So yes.
Trying to find a delicate way to say
that. Some of it's like, oh my God, I can't even believe that. So what I do as the director of the program at Seabury Hall is I have a guest artist series. So I bring in two or three guest artists every year to work with my students because I, yes, am not able to do all of that stuff. I mean, I have a ballet mistress. We do jazz. We do musical theater. We do modern dance. But I'm not a hip-hop break dancer. I don't do some of these really contemporary forms. But I know the kids hunger to do it. So I will bring in a master from outside who can give them a couple-week workshop and set a piece. And then that accomplishes what, you know, it brings that stuff into our program.
Yeah, and David, I wasn't describing that as a limitation. It's just that there's so many different things that come along every.
But it's true. It is a limitation. I mean, after 40 years in the business, like, I don't think I can do that. Let me bring someone else in who can share that.
Well, you know, one of the great things about a dance style, as you say, cultural dances like hula, unlike ballet, you don't really age doesn't knock you out of participation in dances like hula, does it?
Well, and that's so true. You know, that's one of the really beautiful things about hula. I mean, sometimes, you know, you'll see, you know, you'll go and see some keiki perform, and in the next moment you have, you know, one of our elders out there doing a hula who's been doing it, you know, her whole life. And in the simplicity, the beauty, the grace that,
yeah,
you know, is just, yeah.
Well, the you know, older artists that have been doing it for decades and decades are frequently all about nuance. They pull back from elaborate displays of technique, but the subtlety is something that very few young artists can reach. Yeah?
Well, that's right. In fact, last week we had a dance program at our school, which was our kind of recital program. And my ballet mistress and myself performed in a couple pieces together, very different than we would have done 15 years ago. But we also like the kids to see that we're still out there. We're still capable to captivate and perform, but we do it now exactly what you said, with nuance and richness and years of experience, rather than, you know, jumping 10 feet in the air and falling down into the splits, you know.
it's just so appropriate, David, because, you know, and the whole idea of an artist is to just get better and better until you drop, right?
That's it. You only bring the years of experience you have, and it only makes you, I think, you know, it just gives you that confidence to just be able to be present, and that has power in itself, right?
It sure does. Well, David, I hope this becomes a tradition over there.
Just to conclude with, this is a dream come true for me to begin this festival at this wonderful new facility we have at Seabury. And my hopes and dreams is that right now we're starting with Maui island-wide, and I hope that this can become a statewide program where we're inviting groups from all over the islands to come to Maui and join us and share their love and passion for the movement arts.
Well, we'll keep in touch about this, David. Thanks so much for talking with us. David Ward is the director of dance at Seabury Hall on Maui, which is holding its first annual Common Ground Dance Festival this weekend, and you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Matson, whose employees and their families volunteer with local charities, including the March of Dimes March for Babies this spring and the American Heart Association's Heart Walk in the summer. Learn more at matson.com/foundation.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, what do King Solomon and David Lee Roth have in common?
I saw brown M&Ms on the catering table, then guaranteed the promoter had not read the contract, writer.
Clever ways to sort the guilty from the innocent. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
Thursday evening at 7, following With Good Reason.
Beth Ann, Neil Conan alluded to a lot of things that have been really not discussed enough about the sport of football. We're learning more practically on a daily basis about what has been kind of pushed to the side and what we need to know about the effects of playing football on young bodies, on young heads especially.
And why the whole issue of Deflategate possibly going up to the Supreme Court has ramifications that go well beyond the issue of the footballs themselves and what happened in that case, but really having to do with a lot of issues of education and, yeah, hubris of celebrities and sort of disregarding things that we should not be disregarding.
It's tough for Americans to let that go because we do worship our sports, but time to rethink a few things.
Yeah, well, today, earlier in the show, you talked about a sport that has some very worthy people of being worshipped.
That's a great story.
That's a great story about the Sugar Ditch Kids. Love that.
Yeah.
More good things coming your way tomorrow. We're going to be talking about whether the state should be buying Dole agricultural lands on Oahu. Senator Gil Riviere will be here to weigh in on that one. Also, we'll look at the Airbnb taxation bill with Senator Laura Thielen.
And we'll talk with pioneering rock guitarist June Millington on a too rare visit to Hawaii. We'd like to hear from you at our talkback line, and you can get your comments there and record them at 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of the show, want to find other good things, just look on the archive for the conversation. It's right under talk shows.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning for more of the conversation.